Welcome to the film experience. I am Nathaniel, and I'm here once again with Murtala.
Hello.
And we have a special guest today, breaking his what appears to have been a long internet fast, Nick Davis.
The comeback queen.
Well, we're happy to have you back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Narrative. He's going to be nominated.
I feel like Valerie Cherish. Not for the first time.
Let's start with Shoplifters. And who would be great at summing this movie up for us? Because I can tell you right now that I will not.
I can take a stab at that. So Shoplifters is the Japanese Oscar entry by Hirokazu Koreeda, who actually not only wrote and directed but edited the film, won the Palme d'Or. And it's about a makeshift family who sort of survive by petty crimes, among them shoplifting. And it's basically about what a family is. Is it just, can a group of people come together and decide to be a family? And will social institutions allow them to do that or not?
Well done.
Yeah, very beautiful summary, which I could not have managed. So, because I will say, when this movie started, I did not know what to expect, and I also didn't know, this is a shameful secret, I also didn't know if I would like it or not, because the descriptions as such, I was like, not sure if I want to see a makeshift family committing petty crimes, but it's not really a crime drama, it's much more of like a beautiful, like, poetic essay about family.
Mm-hmm. So I think we all really liked it.
I don't want to speak for you. I loved it.
He loved it.
I think it is my preference for Best Foreign Film at the Academy of this year.
Laying down that gold gauntlet. Fuck you, Burning.
And Roma.
Eat it, Roma.
I love those movies too, don't get me wrong.
I not only is it my favorite for Best Foreign Film, I think it has my favorite actress performance from Sakura Ando as the mother.
She's great. And in such a quiet part, and like, I mean, not to get derailed so quickly, but like for such a quiet year in supporting actress, I would be, I mean, it's not going to happen, but like there's every reason in the world for her to be talked up a ton.
Yes. Everybody and all the actors in the movie, they work well together, right? Like you believe them as these people trying to form a family, but she just stands out because she also has to carry a lot of like the emotional baggage in the scenes where, let's say, the family's fracturing and they meet, you know, some ignorant figures of authority.
Yeah. And I remember when the jury, I don't know how recently you two saw it. I saw it a month ago at the Chicago Film Festival. But I remember when the Con jury gave it the prize, they made a point of saying that it was their favorite because every single element seemed so precisely calibrated and that it wasn't about huge moments or kind of big dramatic beats, but just kind of immaculate judgment scene by scene, which I admired a lot about it while I was watching it. I felt like the movie nailed that even better than a lot of other Koreeda movies that I've seen, which I've been kind of up and down on. Mm-hmm. I do find that it makes it a little bit trickier to remember now, a month later. I remember a kind of a vibe and a texture more than tons of specifics. But I think that's actually a sign of the movie maybe doing what it wants. Because it couldn't possibly be a sign of my own failings. That's not what it is.
No, that's exactly how I feel about it, too. I have trouble, like, pinpointing, which is why I wanted someone else to describe it. I have a trouble articulating what is so brilliant about it, because it's more of, like, a cumulative punch as a movie goes than any particular...
Mm-hmm.
Even, as much as I like the actors, than any particular actor or the cinematography or anything. It's just the general takeaway from it. I was very moved by the end, and I saw it a month and a half ago, and have never stopped thinking about it.
Yeah. We saw it together at the New York Film Festival. What I the, one
You're
of the
a
things
family.
Going we are. One of the things I also liked about it, which I usually don't like in movies, I don't like movies that spell their themes to the audience. But not only does Shoplifters do that, the characters actually tell us, sometimes even looking directly at the camera, what they're going through and why they are in this family, which should not work really, but it works so beautifully.
I think one of the reasons that that works, and if I may speak from personal experience,
you're a shoplifter.
I am not a shoplifter.
Daniel is a thief.
I would be a terrible shoplifter because I would have guilt all over my face at all moments because I cannot disguise what I'm feeling at any moment. I think gay people can speak to this more. It is not even remotely a gay film. There are no gay characters, no gay themes, anything like that. But the idea of makeshift families, I completely bought the speaking directly to that theme because most gay people I know actually articulate that in their own lives quite often as opposed to, and it's, I don't want to say that it's a self-justification, but it's because it's not what society deems a family that you end up constantly making a case that it is a family.
Yeah. So I thought that same thing after seeing it, and appreciated how the movie was modeling that and even sort of slowly revealing, or maybe, unless I missed an earlier moment where this was announced, I don't feel that the like non-biological relationship among the members of this family was completely clear early on.
It was not. But, I was concerned about that.
But
with
the
spoilers.
Fact that. Yeah. And so the fact that the movie just kind of. That did not feel to me like one of the, when you're talking, Murtada, about the ways in which the movie sometimes even risks speaking its themes a little bit, like, that was not one that I felt like the movie needed to make rhetorical, but just showed us. And I love that about it, and made, I mean, in that way, it's kind of an interesting movie to talk about on Thanksgiving week, where the families people are choosing to be with, or choosing not to be with, or have the ability or not the ability to be with, really resonates. So it's kind of great they released it now. I'm sure that's not why they did, but
yeah, that's, I actually haven't thought about it that way, but yeah, it does make for a perfect Thanksgiving film. I did ask, I interviewed Koreeda and I asked him about that, why he made that choice. And his answer to me, which I liked, was that he, to some of the things you were saying, Nathaniel, is that he felt that he didn't make clear the relationships between the different characters. And so he didn't want to have any ambiguity about why they came together. So he had them do that, which I thought was interesting.
Mm. I also like about this movie that there's not, well, two more things I'll throw out. One, that even like the kind of, what I remember is the first sequence where you see the first kind of family raid on a sort of grocery store, that you're seeing exactly what they're doing in kind of the totally modest way in which they do it, just using other people's unsuspecting bodies as screens for, like, by which they accomplish what this is. But it's not really a sequence about their ingenuity or about like sort of forced suspense, nor the scenes where the shoplifting doesn't quite work. So I liked that the movie's kind of quietness and equilibrium was the same, even in moments that could have been maximized for attention.
Yeah, it is.
I'm going to say a second thing, and I can't remember what it was. Go for it.
It is sort of, it is very quiet. Like, you would think this movie that sort of have these characters who open sort of their hearts and their wounds and tell us, you know, how they're feeling would be emotionally a little bit of high tone, high voice, a bit melodramatic, but it's not that at all. It's so quiet, but so beautifully done. And even if it is, you know, some of this, that plot is a little melodramatic, it's just that the way that it is presented to you, you can't help but be moved so much. Not that I'm against melodrama, but I think it's just quieter than I thought it would be.
Yes. And even literally so, because one thing I've resisted in some of his other movies is that he has a Clint Eastwood-y sympathy for the tinkling piano, and sometimes, like, really needs his music to push what's definitely already happening in the framing and in the acting, and I felt like this movie was a lot more restrained on that front. And the fact that the way it's set up, this was the other thing I was going to say, you kind of imagine you'll be getting this young boy's perspective on all of this the whole way through, which could also be a real route into sentiment. But I love that the movie doesn't stick to just one kind of focal character, and you do feel over time, like even where the camera is placed, is pulling different characters' perspectives into the mix, and that you do kind of get looped into feeling like you're just part of this family rather than experiencing the whole thing from one vantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy to drop yourself in. And I do, you know, people might say that this is like engineered for, you know, maximum emotional manipulation. You can make that argument about lots of melodramas. But I loved the sort of arc of the narrative arc, not a character arc, but the narrative arc of what happens with the little girl. At the beginning of the movie, they basically adopt a new member of the family, this little girl who is clearly being not abandoned completely, but ignored by her parent or whatever the situation is, and so they take her home with them. And I loved what happens with that, because it places you in this uncomfortable situation of sort of condemning societal norms.
Yeah.
Because you know that you realize very quickly within the movie that she's better off with this family who is, by all accounts in a normal society, a criminal, marginal family.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so clear that she's better off with them. So it's this very emotionally, like, you might say it's manipulative, but it completely works because of the humanistic complexity of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also works as an indictment of all these, you know, social institutions that are in charge of, like, who would sort of decide who this girl should stay with. The movie sort of acts as indictment of those institutions, which is, but also in a very sort of, like, it doesn't scream this loudly, right? Like, it is just by presenting this story, like, you leave with a lot of frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making it probably sound like a painful movie to watch, which I did not find. Even though it's upsetting, it's so rich that I was like, I never once was like, oh God, that was a bear to sit through. Like, I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's the opposite of that. It was so beautiful to just watch this family and enjoy them and see them come together. There is a lot of beautiful poignant scenes of just that makes you sort of like, you know, if it's not hyperbole, just love humans more.
Some humans.
Some, yeah. Carefully selected mixture of family members.
Human characters written by Coriade. Let's put it that way.
Not all criminals. Hashtag. I keep thinking about it in relationship to Roma, and I find that Roma is a movie that I really love, but almost every time I'm talking about it, I'm saying something critical about it. I don't know what's going on exactly with that, but maybe especially because, in the sense that, like, the Cannes winner and the Venice winner, if you watch them back to back, neither of these is, like, the wrong way to go, but I might have more of an affinity for, like, Shoplifter's kind of quiet build than Roma's kind of self-conscious monumentality, even though it's such an amazing thing to experience in the theater. I also felt like, in a way, like, I understand that one thing that Cuarón is doing in Roma is trying to mark that he knows he does not know everything about this woman that he grew up around, and that part of the limit of Roma's access to her is a kind of ethical choice. But it still felt to me like this movie feels way more like it was made by somebody who was inside that family and maybe even a member of it, even though he wasn't. Whereas a lot of the things that I find affecting and even really emotional in Roma feel a little bit like tropes. Like most of the conflicts or struggles that she have are about sort of systemic power or about pregnancy or things that maybe a lot of people who didn't even know her would imagine about her circumstances. And with Shoplifters, I felt like almost every emotional moment is something that is so nuanced and subtle that if you haven't been in that movie for 2 hours, it wouldn't even seem like a beat. And I think that just affected me more and felt like, again, it's not meant to knock Roma, but I think I just like it better.
Yeah, I think we all agree that Roma is an amazing movie. I was just, the reason I brought it up at the beginning was it's one of these clear steamrollers, but I just happen to have a preference for another movie.
Yeah.
I think you made the point, Nathaniel, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks ago when talking about this movie, I don't know if it was on the podcast or just offline, that, you know, Shoplifters, to the point of that Nick was making, has all these characters and you that you feel that they are real people, while Roma, you experience the characters a little bit at a remove. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, I mean, I don't want to say they're contrived, but somewhere they just don't feel as dimensional as all the characters in Shoplifters are.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've said many times talking about Roma, and I probably have said this online and off, even though I love Roma, both of these movies, spoiler alert, are going to be on my top 10 list. So I love them both. Roma is a little bit more, to me, it's completely a director's picture, like 1,000%. Like, when people talk about the acting, I'm always a little confused as to why they find it that compelling. Because to me, it's more of like as Nick described it, more of a monument. It's like sort of like a bombastic statement of like a director's vision. It's like sort of watching like a painter deliver the masterwork, but the subject of the masterwork, this is going to sound damning, I don't mean it that way, is a little arbitrary, if that makes sense.
Mm.
Whereas this didn't feel like a director making a statement or showing off, it just felt like this amazingly intimate story.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my long-winded point is, while I was watching Roma, which I love, I was thinking about Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah.
And while I was watching this, I was not thinking of Corrieta.
And I mostly agree with the spirit of what you're saying, but I think I took it as, in the same way that we talk a lot about the kinds of performances that don't get acknowledged because they're not big acting, I was thinking about Corrieta all the way through this, but in the same way that I watch a quiet performance and kind of check my own tendencies to want to see somebody go full Aaron Brockovich and like actually just admire the perfect performance for that role in that film. And I felt like his choices were that. So it'd be an interesting double feature to get people to think about what they value in direction without feeling like they have to pick one or the other. Mm-hmm. And it's actually interesting, not to force a segue, but since I know we have limited time, like it's like the opposite of what The Favorite is in terms of directing or like relationship to material. I don't know if people are ready to move to that yet, but
yeah, we can move. Because we were talking earlier about it, like we're forgetting specifics. I feel like if I talk about Shoplifters for much longer, I'm just being like, I love it, which is, I'm aware, not that exciting to listen to.
But it's the right reaction about this movie. So as it moves to more cities, you know, make sure to see Shoplifters.
Yes.
You won't regret seeing it.
Yes.
Go see it.
And if the Academy could get over its ridiculous anti-Asian thing in that category, this would be a really great year to resist that thing that you guys do.
But don't you think that it, since it's won the Palme d'Or from this jury, which has at least, I don't know, 4 or 5 Academy members, maybe it will happen.
I mean, I would love that, but it's just so amazing that we're in a position of even having to wonder things like that. I mean, I don't think he's never been even shortlisted as far as I recall. And was Departures the last movie from Japan even nominated?
I believe there was one after that. Japan, they're not as resistant to as the other Asian countries.
Yeah.
But the favorite, yes. a complete 180 from Koreeda in terms of the director, making sure his voice is known.
And I saw them on back-to-back nights, which was just like stereoscopy, like vertigo of some kind. Like, and I liked The Favorite fine. I have not been able to generate like the kind of enthusiasm that I feel like I keep reading about it, but I do like it. I have no idea where you guys are. I think, Murtada, you said you like it, but I don't know how much.
A lot. I like it a lot.
It's completely love it. I'm kind of obsessed with it. I've seen it twice, and I'm eager for a third time.
Well, okay. That's a good report card. Say more, gentlemen.
So tell us about it, Nathaniel. What is The Favorite about?
I always feel so awkward doing these summaries. So for those of you who have not been paying attention, The Favorite, it's about Queen Anne and Lady
Sarah. I like Sarah. The chastisement.
You know, right? It's like I'm a little passive-aggressive that I have to do these intros.
There wasn't, like, tons of passive in that.
It's about Queen Anne and her favorite in her royal court, Lady Sarah, and another woman, Lady Sarah's cousin, shows up looking for a job and eventually starts fighting with Lady Sarah over the queen's favoritism. So it's very insular, as most royal court dramas are. Look at the court the court politics and the sort of limited worldview of these characters who control whole countries, essentially. And just about the machinations of love and favoritism and what people are looking for in relationships. There's arguments about what love is,
mm-hmm.
and which games people are playing, whether or not they're playing them for power or for love. I found it very rich with things to talk about and think about, and it's also just freaking fun because it's Yorgos Lanthimos, the director of The Lobster and Dogtooth and Killer of a Sacred Deer. So his style and tone are so ultra-specific that I love that you have to be on his wavelength when you watch the movies. And that's true to some degree for all movies. Like, you know, you meet the director somewhere in the middle, but with his you have to travel further and join his world.
And if you don't have to travel far to get to this world, you should think about why.
What does it mean?
I said if you don't have to travel to meet Yorgos Lanthimos' world, you might want to think about why that is. And what it means that you already live in it.
Right. But I also like that he's so blatant about the fact that it is someone's vision as opposed to just telling a story. Like, the fisheye lenses and all the ways that he puts up stylistic barriers to accepting something as reality. So you're 100% aware the whole time. It's actually more like going to the theater, in that you're 100% aware that it's all artifice. It's all storytelling. And you are coming to join it where it already is. Which I think is why in some ways he's not as accessible as other master filmmakers. I watched this with a very full crowd, the paying audience, a couple nights ago for my second time. And it was fascinating to me that people seemed to be with it, but they did not seem to be experiencing it as a comedy, which it clearly is.
Interesting. It is. To me, it felt very funny. Very, very funny. And I always felt like I was missing something, like, because sort of the barbed lines come so fast at you all the time, mm-hmm. and that you sometimes you're laughing and then you're afraid to laugh because you're missing the next line that's coming right at you right after it. That was my feeling. I thought it was really, really funny. Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised at that reaction.
I think it's the fact that it's from a genre that is not thought of as a comedy genre.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, even though he gives you, I was talking about him being inaccessible, but he actually does try to help you. He, there's a lot of ways in which the humor is like very blatant. But I felt like people were weirded out that some pockets of the audience were laughing a lot. I just thought it was interesting. So I'm curious to hear from listeners what your experience is like with in theater, if people thought it was funny. I thought it was hilarious.
I recall thinking it was really funny, although in the second hour, especially through Queen Anne, like the movie starts going for pretty different tones, I would say. I mean, I felt like it was an audience that was like, it was sticking in their throat a little bit, that the woman who's kind of been the funniest presence, and Olivia Colman, is so outrageous and hilarious, but just starts playing this woman's anger and sadness and kind of many kinds of pain that she's in. And then I think people started reacting differently at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, I guess this is why Coleman's performance is thought of as the best of the three, even though all three actresses are amazing, is because she sort of had to straddle that line between the ridiculous and the truly heartbreaking in that character. Mm-hmm. And she does it so well, which is interesting for me to hear that you thought it was more of a, like, she was ridiculous first and then heartbreaking, because I think of her, and now that you said it, I realize that that's probably true, but I always thought of her that she was being both at in all times, or mm-hmm. that's how I remember the performance anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's clearly a tragic comedy. I don't want to sell it in a way it's not. It's like a not a Roll in the Aisles type of comedy. But I think
sometimes it's right.
Yes, but I think tragic comedies, anything where comedy has to have another adjective added onto it, I think can be hard for general audiences. I'm not trying to be condescending. I'm just saying mm-hmm. it's a very, very specific tone. So like if you aren't willing to meet it, you're going to have trouble with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's also the most difficult movie of the year, isn't it? You know, all those snorts, all those falls, all the animals, the dancing, it's the ridiculous dancing, mm-hmm. the ridiculous eating. It's just like there are all these things that you remember and you can sort of make them. I think we're going to see a lot of GIFs all over mm-hmm. social media from this movie.
I think one of the reasons I'm thinking so much about how audiences are going to react is, did you guys see the story about Taylor Swift promoting the movie?
No,
so
I did not.
Her boyfriend's in it, so she tweeted out this thing about the favorite is phenomenal, here's how to get tickets, and like swipe for this discount on tickets or whatever. So she's pushing for the movie, right?
Is her boyfriend Joe Alwyn?
He is, yeah.
Okay.
So she has this little video teaser, and it's obviously from the favorite publicity department. It's not something she made, but it's all Joe Alwyn. It's like all of his scenes, like a commercial, basically, where he seems like the star of it. And I was just giggling to myself because I was like, some of Taylor Swift's fans are going to be so thrown if they actually follow her advice and go see this movie.
They made those short videos for all the characters, including the duck. The duck has one, which I
thought. Yes, which is brilliant.
I wonder what person that duck was in a previous life where they couldn't find a companion.
Oh, but even that, like, some of the humor there, like, the first time you see the duck after he wins a race, like, one of the court members carries this duck around with him in every scene, for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet. And they race the ducks, you know, just like silly things to pass the time in the royal court. And so he's always carrying his prize duck around. And in this one scene where he's talking about the dignity of men, you know, because they're at war and stuff, he's like stroking the duck's neck. And it's such a hilarious visual because he's having this very serious conversation, but it's, everything about it is so ridiculous. His outfit's ridiculous, stroking the duck like it's his own penis. I mean, it was a hilarious shot. so funny. And I like, our whole row basically burst out laughing. And so many people in the theater were quiet, and I was like, wow, okay.
So you don't want to do murder to yourself when he uses the fisheye lenses, because I do. And I feel like it's like looking back at like something you used to wear or some affectation you used to have where you're like, why was I doing that? I just feel in Killing of a Sacred Deer as well. Like I understand your point for sure that like this is about making sure nobody disappears into like the realism of these court scenes. Mm-hmm. But there's so much else in the movie that's also doing that, and it just, I just don't understand it at all. It's so ugly. Like, looking at any of the shots that include it, it just feels kind of like, that to me does play as a case of a director being so out ahead of his movie and making sure we haven't forgotten that somebody made it. And just playing around with stuff. I'm like, I'm cool with playing around with stuff, but... And it wasn't like Killing of a Sacred Deer, which I felt like I couldn't relate to that movie at all, except as a demonstration of how much he wanted to show us him directing something. But it kind of lost points with me a little bit on that score, I guess.
I didn't mind it, because to me the subject was so... about excess in so many ways, and about people not being able to rein in the impulses. You know, a lot of the tragedy of it is that the queen has no self-control.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people aren't self-aware. To me it felt like of a piece with what the movie was doing. Although I totally get that it's an affectation, and affectations are by their nature divisive.
Well, like, maybe, I don't want to sound like, I'm not wanting to be in a camp of, like, taking away a director's idiosyncrasy, but, like, maybe that would have made more sense to me if the film seemed obviously more where Anne is, but I don't think that the Rachel Weisz character or the Emma Stone character, who all kind of have equal weight, have the same problems that she has. I mean, in some ways, I guess you could argue that they do. But if there was anything I kind of felt more reserved about with the movie, I did not. I love, like, I mean, you used the duck example. Like, the things in the movie where the direction is just bringing out comedy or absurdity scene by scene, I often liked. But I did not always feel like they also serve to clarify the bigger picture here of this story, or that there were things that clearly interested him, I thought, in this script, and other things that didn't much. And it was kind of funny that he just doesn't care about war, really, or like the intricacies of the court. But it did feel a bit piecemeal to me.
Hmm. Yeah, because I was going to ask for an example of what he doesn't care about, but I guess I view him, his whole stylization of this movie as being queen-centric.
Mm-hmm.
Everything revolving around her, because she clearly did not care about the war.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, doesn't even know.
It was a total abstraction.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the way I viewed how he was viewing everything.
And yeah. I actually like that. I like that he was mostly just interested in the relationship between these three women, and not in anything else, because, you know, I didn't want to go to France with Sarah's husband or whatever it is. And I'm not saying that that's what you are asking for, Nick, but I like the containment in just concentrating on these three characters.
I guess it just felt to me like maybe the Rachel Weisz character is the one that's the hardest for me to reconcile with the way the movie's directed, in a way, and in scenes that really privileged her priorities or what she cares about or thinks about, I felt like the movie was shakiest. In a way that maybe I kind of enjoyed the movie all the way through while I was watching it, but did feel some unevenness of how interested I was in each of these women or how clear they seemed to me. And now I mostly just think of it as an amazing movie about Queen Anne, and like an okay movie about the other ones. Emma Stone being somewhere in the middle.
It's so funny. I left the movie quite taken with Rachel Weisz. Like, you know, they have changed in my mind since the three of them, we were going to rank them. But when I left the movie the first time I saw it, it was just all about Rachel, because she gets like all she gets basically the funniest lines and all, like sort of all, if you're into it for the Barb sort of conversation and the lines, and she's like cutting everyone, I thought. And she had the way with sort of like just saying the funny lines in a way that I think she was most comfortable with, or at least that was my perception of it.
This is really funny, because the second time through, I'm starting to think that Emma Stone gives the best performance in the movie. She has what I think is the trickiest part, and I was just, the second time through, I was kind of floored by how well she modulates that, because now that I knew what was going to happen and where the character arcs were going, seeing all the aspects of her character right from the beginning instead of how they slowly revealed themselves to me the first time through.
I mean, she gets a lot of the silences, right? Like, if Rachel is getting a lot of the funny, witty lines, I think there is a lot of, if I remember, there is a lot of scenes where he just puts his camera on Emma and to get sort of just reactions with no lines. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, she plays that up. She uses her face, her eyes, everything really well to sort of like, you know, tell us all about Abigail.
She does have that genetic deformity of having the world's largest eyes, which help her with those reaction shots. I'm kidding.
I mean, I am
seriously, how big are her eyes?
Not as big as Maggie Smith's. Calm down. I am interested in your point about theater, because I felt like there were a lot of ways in which this felt live theatrical to me, and especially in Emma Stone's performance, maybe, where it felt like she was trying a lot of things in her scenes that, like, on the stage, you could imagine the actress trying that stuff, mm-hmm. and maybe the next night not doing any of those things. Like, it just felt like she was being licensed to make lots of different kind of spontaneous choices, like the weird snorts and, like, the impersonation of the monster that she's maybe being hired to play for the children, and it did seem like a pretty liberated performance, which I liked a lot about it. And it felt to me different. Not that Rachel Weisz was less so, but I felt like she had committed to a pitch and a register that was not going to change hugely on purpose. And so even seeing the contrast between the way those two women seem to be approaching their characters, I thought kind of was one of the more interesting ways to imagine the tension between them. But I'm still Coleman all the way. And Sandy Powell all the way, obviously, right. Boring, barely needs staying, but like, how did you even get those fabrics to stick together? They don't seem to be sewn, but they make a sleeve. How are you doing that? Like, oh my God.
And she used fabrics that are not usually used in sort of historical films. Like,
from what I remember her saying, that all the fabrics are things purposely that did not exist then. And so, like, all the silhouettes are authentic, but all of the fabrics are things like laser cut leather and things like that that could not have existed. Or not the fabrics, the techniques with which the gowns are made. It was purposely a mix of sort of period authenticity in the shapes and completely modernization in construction and fabric.
I mean, Emma Stone is introduced in a jean dress. That was the first costume that she wears.
Yeah.
Would that we could all say the same. But only further confirming that I know we've invented this rivalry, but like, Colleen Atwood is the De Niro who gave up years ago, and Sandy Powell is the Meryl Streep who is still doing it every time. And I don't think that those first two people have any excuse when they look at the other two people for their laziness.
Yeah. Go Sandy.
Well, we promised we were going to answer Rita questions. So do you have any final comments on the favorite?
even though I didn't like it as much as you guys did, definitely everybody should go see it.
Yes. Actually, one reader question is a good segue, Nathaniel, because I think one of the questions was about who will get the most nominations and how will that affect them in winning. Mm-hmm. Wasn't that? I'm paraphrasing. And you, I think, responded saying that you think, or you have now, that The Favorite will get maybe the most.
Well, I've currently on my prediction charts, which are updated, I have The Favorite and A Star Is Born leading the nominations. But I know that's incorrect, so my crystal ball is faulty because those are the two main contenders that I like the best. So that does not happen, where my two favorites among the main Oscar contenders are the leaders. So I'm prepared to be very wrong, but with The Favorite, it's kind of one of those movies that would be very easy for the various technical branches to nominate it. The question is whether they will. But it's not something that would have a hard time being noticed for any particular element, if that makes sense.
Mm. I'll just go out on a limb. This would be the weirdest thing at the Oscars, but I wonder if Black Panther might get the most nominations.
I have that currently only one nomination behind The Favorite. Mm. But yes, that could happen as well. I do think that the nomination tally is far less meaningful than people tend to make it, and I think that has more to do with sort of our sort of brainwashing of Oscar history. Because for decades and decades, that usually meant you were going to win Best Picture. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. That hasn't really meant that in a long time.
Yep.
Who got the most nominations last year?
I think it was The Shape of Water last year, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I mean, it's not like it never happens. It just doesn't.
No, but it was.
It no
that
longer
wasn't
indicates that you're going to win.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Screw you, Benjamin Button. Not that what happened instead was any better, but like still.
So this question was from Ian Daly.
So I hope that answered. So I do think any other contenders for that besides Black Panther, The Favorite, and A Star Is Born, anyone else have something they think could be the one that does it?
I mean, from the reaction to Mary Poppins Returns, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but people seem like the reaction seems to be really amazing so far. And similar to The Favorite and Black Panther, it is another movie that if it gets into Best Picture, then it can get a lot of other nominations down the line, which could add to its total tally.
Mm-hmm. And they all have original songs. I didn't even know that
The
Favorite has an original song until, I mean, I don't know if it's original, but the credits, end credits do have a song, which kind of threw me. I don't know how I noticed it the first time.
It's usually there by Sia, all original songs.
It is not. What was the other reader question, Bertana?
So the other reader question was from Fabian Egarniza. I'm sorry if I'm saying your name wrong, but his question was, what is going on with Mary, Queen of Scots?
That's a question people have been asking for 500 years. What is going on with Mary, Queen of Scots?
What even is her claim to the throne?
Well,
you've actually seen it, right, Murtada?
I've seen it, yes.
Are you about it?
I would be like, about it. Like, it's fine for what it is, what it's trying to do. I don't think this is a movie that comes at the end of in December and, like, shakes things and people are suddenly like, oh, this is my favorite movie of the year. I don't think that. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking Oscars, like, maybe Alexandra Byrne for costumes, but that would be it.
But even that I kind of object to, I have to say, because, I mean, I should note I missed the screening, so I'm seeing it in a couple days, but so this is purely philosophical objection, but she already won an Oscar for this exact story, so I'm kind of irritated that that they even hired the same person to do it again, because she costumed Elizabeth the Golden Age, which also tells this story.
But don't you feel like collaborating with Shekhar Kapoor and putting up with his big bag of crazy is probably different than any other job you would have, even if it's the same story? Like, I know the hats are not going to be the same.
Yeah.
The hats are not the same, but I think I remember, like, the dress that Mary wears, I seem to remember, and, you know, who knows if my memory is correct, you know, Elizabeth the Golden Age was so long ago, but, like, the silhouette of what Samantha Morton was wearing in that, in most of her scenes, and kind of looks like what Saoirse Ronan wears here, too, and they are playing, you know, Mary.
Well, I mean, it's a historical drama, so, like, I get that people have specialties, you know, certain people specialize in certain periods, but it still feels a little like if you're going to make a film of a story that's been told on film more than once before, like, shouldn't the idea be that you have a fresh take on it? I haven't seen it again. This is all a philosophical objection.
Yeah. I wonder if it's like when an actor is like, oh my God, this is the only kind of part anybody is ever thinking of me for, so it's up to me to make this interesting. Like, I can easily see it going the way you're talking about, but I also wonder if it's like, well, this is the gig on my plate. Let me try to not repeat myself and sort of take another stab. I don't actually feel any optimism about this movie. I am, like, so I don't know why I'm being so, like, protective of the possibility that it might be better, but. And I am curious, my impression of the trailer is that Margot Robbie seems, like, manifestly more interesting in it than Saoirse Ronan, but is that true of your experience of the film?
No, not at all. She is hardly in the film. Most of her scenes are just her sort of telling the people in her court, the men in her court, that they don't take her seriously because she's a woman. Keeps repeating that, and then...
She's really stuck on that.
Yes, and then in the end, she has the big scene, which, you know, the imagined scene between the queens, which is pretty amazing, and she is pretty amazing in it, but it is firmly Saoirse Ronan's role. Mary, it is called Mary Queen of Scots for a reason, in that it's completely about her, and not about Elizabeth at all.
And I've heard that the handsome blonde Dunkirk guy is really good in it.
Yes. He's Mary's husband. He's great in it.
Which actor are we talking about?
Is he called Felton? Like Jack Felton or something?
Jack Lowden, I think.
He's not an actress, so none of us have any idea what this person's called. I've heard that he's good.
What I liked about the film is that it's casting. It's imaginative in its casting. So you find actors, among them Gemma Chan and Adrian Lester, playing people in the court of the queens, and this is something that you don't usually see in historical movies like this, so that I appreciated. So maybe they didn't, you know, they didn't do anything imaginative with the costumes that hasn't been done before, but I think with the casting and with some of the story elements, they were more imaginative.
Okay. All right.
I'm a sucker for costume drama. I mean, I want to see it. I just, again, all philosophical objections.
All right.
What was that, Nick?
Oh, no, go ahead.
One more. I'm not sure this was a question, but it's sort of a question, so let's discuss it. We said we would discuss questions. Heartful said, can we discuss the box office disappointment of Widows? An auteur decides to build a heist movie around a black woman in midlife, and despite critical acclaim and artistic merit, audiences are distracted by conventional choices. Hello, this is Jackie Brown all over again.
The wound is still too raw from the box office results of Widows.
What do you guys think the issue is of why it underperformed? Because
is it that awful poster? That poster was so bad.
The poster is terrible, actually. Like, you would almost not know it was a Viola Davis movie because there's so many faces on the poster and they're all, like, sort of slivered up. Mm-hmm. It's a typical way to sell ensembles, but I've never really understood it because...
It's also very dark. You can't see anyone.
Yeah.
I think maybe, like, the poster is just the tip of the iceberg, right? Maybe just the marketing was wrong. I don't know. It's so easy to blame box office and marketing because they're so, you know, co-related directly to each other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we could certainly talk if we had longer about, like, the long-term habits of how movies starring black women get marketed, even those same visual... You could say everything you just said about the posters of Widows and say them about Jackie Brown, in fact. But, yeah, I think the movie... I felt to me like it really struggled to sell to the, like, heist audience while also selling to the character actor audience or whoever the perceived Viola Davis audience is. But I also think there was a bit of a word-of-mouth problem because a lot of the... Like, the women in my film group, for example, who were really excited to see a Viola Davis movie were not prepared to see the... It's not like it's a violent movie all the way through, but when it delivers violence, it really delivers it.
Yeah, it's very... The violence is very upsetting. It's short, but it's very upsetting violence.
So I think some of the things that make the movie interesting, and I might even say interestingly uneven, I know you've already talked about this film, are also the things that make it a little hard to market or... Even people who liked it or people who didn't don't seem sure whether to recommend it to other people, I've noticed. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the box office this weekend was not... it didn't drop enormously, so it didn't... It wasn't massacred on its second weekend, but it didn't really have a ton of staying power either, so it's sort of in between. So it's clearly going to be perceived as, like, an underperformer, which is too bad, but I do think it's a movie that's complicated enough that it's going to... It's always silly to say this is going to age well because you just never know, but
yeah,
it is something that people, I think, will be surprised by when they revisit if they only remember that, oh, that's that heist movie that, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's so much to think about it. One thing I really like about it is just how overstuffed it is, which sometimes I don't respond well to in movies, but for this particular movie, I really did.
Yeah.
Maybe because I don't love the heist genre in general, so I need more to think about when I'm watching a heist movie.
Yeah.
But then maybe that's the problem. Maybe the natural audience for this movie is not the natural audience for a heist movie.
Well, the natural audience for this movie in one way is a Chicago audience, and here you wouldn't even know that it's not a hit because everybody's talking about it.
Okay.
It has,
well, that's
like,
good to know.
Quite a few screens at every multiplex, I think, because it's so genuinely invested in what it wants to say about Chicago.
That's actually good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe miraculously it will have some legs.
Like Elizabeth Debicki legs. Really long, long legs.
That's asking for a lot.
Or Cynthia Erivo faster than a speeding bullet legs. Like, either of those would be good.
Murtada is actually off to a very exciting screening right now.
Yes, I'm so excited to see my beloved Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins.
So Murtada's actually beating me to that movie. I'm green with envy at the moment, but I'm seeing it in a couple days. But yes. So we should send you on your way. I'm going to grill Nick about Creed 2 as a little postscript, but we don't want you to be late for your movie.
All right. Well, thank you for having me again, and I'll talk to you everyone soon. Bye.
Great.
Bye.
Good luck.
Okay, so, Nick.
Yeah.
You and I were both, this is the PS section, the epilogue. You and I were both really big fans of Creed.
Yes.
And I think you had it in your top 10 that year.
I did.
So, I have to know, since I haven't seen it yet, Creed 2.
I think it's a completely easy sit, and it is entertaining enough, but, like, those are not the things I was hoping to say when I left Creed 2, and it's not the stuff I said. I mean, Creed, the first one, was an amazingly entertaining sit. But this movie does feel... So one thing I didn't know about it is that Sylvester Stallone wrote it, and it does feel like way more of a Rocky template movie, and less interested in sort of interrogating the genre, interrogating the Rocky mythology, doing it, but also thinking about it, that I thought Creed was so good at. And this just does feel like kind of Rocky IV retrofitted to these characters.
Okay.
And even during the movie, there's a way in which the first half and the second half, in ways the characters keep talking about, almost go through the same beats. Like, you know how this went in hour one. Why are you doing it again in hour two? And I, you know, you hate to, like, pick at people on their, like, first big break, but, like, this director does not radiate the kind of confidence with the material that Ryan Coogler did. The cinematographer, who's one of those cinematographers I see their name on a lot of stuff, like, Kramer Morgenthau, I think he's called, but I can never remember what he's shot, and this is why. Like, Maurice Alberti is one thing, and this is another. So, like, there's not, like, an interesting visual relationship to the characters or to the fight scenes, mm-hmm. or to Philadelphia, or to Los Angeles, or to Moscow.
Okay.
Those are five big things to miss. So it's, like, fine, but it was exactly the movie I was worried that First Creed could be, and so wasn't.
Mm,
and,
okay.
and this feels like it's that.
Well, I mean, even from the poster, I know this is a silly thing to complain about, because that's a different department than the filmmakers, but I mean, not the first poster, which was all Michael B. Jordan, but the new poster is very much, it feels like it's saying, we're doing Rocky IV again.
Yeah. Is it him versus the Ukrainian guy?
Yeah, but also Sly and Dolph are both on the poster, too, so they're all sort of facing off, and I was like, oh, it's Rocky IV again.
Yeah.
So as someone who grew up with 80s movies, like, anybody who grew up with 80s movies would see this and be like, oh, Rocky IV.
Totally. Anybody who grew up with Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
This
is the only Rocky movie many gay men have seen.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. He kind of carries himself on screen better than you might guess. Bridget Nielsen shows up and looks super confused, like what she's supposed to do. The movie maybe could have just decided to not try to explore the Dragos at all, and because it's too invested in them, it's clear that it's trying to do something with them and use them to mirror some of the same things going on in the characters we know better, but there's not enough of them for that to really work. The movie's definitely not interested in, like, using this as any way to, like, stage a U.S. versus Russia 2018 thing.
Which could have been really interesting right now.
Totally. And, like, I was reading some reviews this morning, that most of which liked it better than I did. And I get why several of them said, like, I'm kind of glad the movie evaded that, because what would it even do? But Rocky IV was, like, super invested in that stuff. So it does feel like, to have that be the one thing this movie tries to not update right now seemed a little, like, disappointing. But yeah, just as a kind of cinema moment, I ate my hamburger and my tater tots at the dine-in AMC. I had a good little time in my recliner, but, like, I would not tell anybody to make sure they caught it.
Yeah, that's what I was worried about.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll probably see it, but I'm just not sure I'm going to rush, you know.
Yeah.
Especially with all the Oscars stuff.
And you do feel for sure like Tessa Thompson and Michael B. Jordan, as always, are up to doing more than this script is asking of them, and they are having to find some ways around, like, Sylvester Stallone-authored dialogue, which is not always the greatest. And, like, who doesn't want to hang out with Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson? So, like, it's not, like, a bad time, but it's just not an event.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that sad news. But
can I you
mostly
one question?
We have very good news, and that The Favorite
yeah.
and Shoplifters are both out, and you really have to see them.
You do. Can I ask you one question before we go? Do we have time?
Sure.
We might not. Because the other movie I saw last night was Museo, which I didn't really get along with that well, but you love it. So have you talked about that already before?
Only in passing. And I will say that I don't... It's one of those movies that I saw it a couple days before Toronto. It's sort of like a pre-TIFF screening, since it was a TIFF movie.
Yeah.
So I sort of saw it right before I saw 30 movies. So it's a little bit of a blur.
Yeah.
aside from the heist sequence, which I thought was just amazingly shot and edited, but that's a very small portion of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
That I still remember fairly vividly, and I remember the sort of, that I enjoyed how subversive I felt the sort of narrative of, like, post-heist,
mm-hmm.
which is not something that I feel most heist movies care about at all.
Yeah.
And this movie was all about, oh, so we managed this incredible heist, but now what? Now it's even more trouble than it was before.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting angle. And I tend to... And I'm a sucker for Gael Garcia Bernal movies, so I enjoyed it. That probably doesn't answer your question. But I liked the... I guess I liked the subversion of that genre and the mm-hmm. sort of wandering, meandering qualities of somebody who thinks that they're doing something for a particular reason, and then once it's done... none of their reasons sort of line up with anything.
Yeah.
And I liked that sort of wandering and that stuff.
Yeah. I am curious to... I'm going to go back to see Widows again soon because I'm teaching it in that film group. And as two movies that have their own reasons for picking up the heist genre, I in relationship to a pretty specifically chosen cultural environment... Mm-hmm. They're not really like each other at all, but I think it will be interesting to go from that back into Widows.
Yeah.
But it was another case just in reference to our earlier part of the conversation where I just felt like this director was definitely kind of... I appreciate that he has ideas about scenes. So many directors just don't. And he had ideas about almost every scene, but it did feel a bit like a reel for him than necessarily convincing me that this was in sync with who these characters are, or that the ideas from sequence to sequence really cohered super well. And even
think probably that, fair, but it's a first film, right?
It's a second film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I just think he's exciting enough visually, and like
yeah.
you said, he has ideas about his material, which is always a treat.
Yeah,
I, for one, liked it enough that I made sure to note his name, and I will be paying attention, and if, like, the next time he's at a festival, I'm seeing that regardless what the plot is.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I felt about that, which to me is high praise.
Excellent. That's what I wanted to know.
And, you know, sometimes, that doesn't always pay off, I will say, that sort of, this director amazed me the first time I saw them, so I'm just going to run to the next thing. But one way it did pay off this year, and I've mentioned the movie before, but I just want to say it again, for those of you who pay attention to the foreign film race, that paid off for me like crazy this year with Benedict Erlingsson.
Oh, yeah.
Who made the Icelandic movie Of Horses and Men a few years ago, and that was the Icelandic submission that year. And this year, he made the Icelandic submission Woman at War, which is even better than his debut. But they're both amazing movies, so... I wanted to bring him up as another example of directors where you're always aware that the director has a vision, and you are watching that vision. And I tend to respond well to those movies, even if some people find that off-putting, knowing that the man behind the curtain is there.
And, like, even though I've been like had variable reactions to it in this conversation, I will always take that over the opposite, I think, mm-hmm. probably. Now I'm just, like, stretching out our PS. But, like, I so badly wanted to see that movie because I liked Of Horses and Men so much, too, but also because you were so in love with it at Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it was at the Chicago Festival this year, but I didn't make it because my friend and I had just gone to the career tribute to Ruth Carter right beforehand, and we did not feel like thinking about anything except Ruth Carter for the next, like, 2 hours.
That is so fair.
Yeah.
Because Ruth Carter does not get enough people thinking about her.
Yeah.
Hopefully and that's changing this year.
Yeah. Hopefully so.
Because as Sandy Powell famously said when she won her third Oscar, mm-hmm. I only have two of these.
Yeah. Right. And also, famously said, you know, I wanted, didn't she also dedicate that third one to everybody who doesn't do period historical drama, ever gets recognized? So, like, I guess Black Panther is kind of in and kind of not in that, you know, spirit of her comment. But have you gone to anything that Ruth Carter's done? Because I know she's been picking up, like, lifetime achievements everywhere. But have you talked to her?
I have not talked to her, no. I wish that I had asked for an interview before all the career tribute stuff started happening, because it's going to be probably hard to get her now.
Yeah. One thing I loved that she talked about with the Wakanda costuming was how determined she was to not put fucking computers on people's clothes and, like, signal technological advancement with the idea that the clothes themselves were technologically enhanced. And both because she's like, that shit, like, 5 years later always looks dated. I don't care how sleek and awesome you think you're doing it now.
Right.
That's going to age. But also, it's just so literal. And I thought that this, that Nation has had advanced technology for so long that they aren't thinking about it all the time. And that it was important to make clothes that you couldn't have made without being an advanced culture. But there's no reason to flaunt it at each other. So, like, she used the example of, she had a name for it, and I can't remember what she calls it, but the kind of giant headdress that Angela Bassett is wearing when she receives T'Challa when he first lands, that they actually made as a 3D printed, that is a 3D printed object. With some digital enhancement. But she said that's the kind of thing that you should look at that and think, how did they even make that? Like, Wakanda must know how to do everything, but not actually see it as futuristic.
Right.
And that was just one story of many that I thought were pretty fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to her moment at the Oscars, which I assume is coming.
Let's hope.
I think if Black Panther is going to win anything, it's going to win that.
I hope so.
So that, once again, this is your host, Nathaniel, and I want to thank Murtada, who had to run to Mary Poppins Returns, but who can blame him, and Nick, who we're so thrilled to have back.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.